I'm Ben Lima. Our guest today is Abigail Solomon Godeau, author of Photography After Photography, Gender, Genre, History, and Professor Emerita at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Before becoming an art historian, Abigail Solomon Godeau was a freelance critic, curator, and photographic critic and historian. She's curated exhibitions including The Way We Live Now, Sexual Difference, Both Sides of the Camera, Mistaken Identities, and The Image of Desire, Femininity, Modernity, and the Birth of Mass Culture in 19th Century France. She's written several books, including Photography at the Dock, Essays on Photographic History, Institutions and Practices, Male Trouble, A Crisis in Representation, and most recently, Photography After Photography, Gender, Genre, History, which is out now from Duke University Press. Her new book is an inquiry into the circuits of power that shape photographic practice, criticism, and historiography, tracing the relationships between photography, culture, gender, and power, and exposing photography's embeddedness in social relations, viewing relations, and ideological formations. Thank you for being with us today. I wanted to start by talking about some of the context and background of your work. So how were you first drawn to photography as a subject?
I work professionally in publishing as a picture editor, publishing before all of the technological and practical and corporate changes that made of publishing another completely different form of production. I was actually hired to find the appropriate photographs for the textbook division at that time of Holt Reinhardt Winston, which under the pressure of the time now had to rework their textbooks so that there were people of color, there were gay people, there was a massive restructuring of the, how shall we say, the form of textbooks that required massive picture research. These were for textbooks in history, social science, sociology. And so my first job in publishing was essentially to find the photographs that would go with the text, that would be in turn a textbook, where if a place like the state of California or Texas adopted a textbook, the publisher made a fortune because that whole state would buy that textbook. So this was an all-woman profession, which should tell you something immediately, sort of at the bottom of the food chain, as it were. But the pleasure was you got to go to photographic agencies, to photographic archives, to libraries, and find the appropriate photographs that you would then submit to the editor of the book. And of course, in those primitive days also, we would do the, the mock-ups, cutting up pages of type with an X-Acto knife, pasting it down, scaling the photograph so it would fit on the page. And that was how I first started working with photography.
So before you entered the field of art and art history, you had this broad and deep knowledge of
the culture industry, we would call it, or the propaganda industry, or the, how shall I say, the educational apparatus. Because that's what I was feeding into. So as I said, I think in one of the introductions to my book, you don't need to read Roland Barthes to learn about ideology and pictures if you've worked in the publishing industry or in any of the forms in which you use photographs. And that was how the actual work of being a photo researcher, or later a picture editor, and my own political affiliations synergistic relationship.
You know, that somehow reminds me, Barbara Kruger, didn't she work for Mademoiselle or something doing layout
yes.
before developing her own critical practices?
Yeah, exactly. It was in the course of working for magazines, doing design, doing pictures, she, I think, made the same kind of connections I did, which, of course, profoundly affected
yeah.
her practice as an artist.
Yeah. Wow. So you were in contact with the brilliant art historian and critics Linda Nochlin and Rosalind Krauss, and you decided to go back to graduate school at a certain point. Can you talk about that stage of?
Well, that was much later.
Yeah.
I had my years in publishing. Then I formed a small business that was a picture research business to
yeah.
provide photographs for various, mostly publishing clients. Then I got married and moved to Paris. Then I came back to New York and decided that I wanted to write about having spent 2 years in Paris libraries educating myself on the history of photography,
wow.
which at that point, we're talking 1978 to 1980, had not yet really been integrated into
right.
the university, was not yet really a disciplinary entity,
right.
but where I had the ruin of the Bibliothèque Nationale,
wow.
various archives, and because I knew Rosalind Krauss socially,
uh-huh.
this was even before I knew Linda, I had an immediate conduit, if as it were,
right.
to start publishing in journals like October.
Right, right.
However, after several years trying to survive as a freelance critic,
yeah.
scholar, curator, it became absolutely evident that it was not possible to
right.
make a living like that in New York City.
Yeah.
And it was then that Rosalind Krauss and Linda Nochlin, whom I had met shortly before, convinced me that it was not possible for me to survive as an independent critic, curator, and that I needed, so to speak, a license to practice.
Yeah, yeah.
And a license to practice means effectively you enter academia, or you enter the museum world, or you enter the marketplace, the
yeah.
gallery. So it was, in my case, a bit overdetermined that I would go the academic
right.
route.
Right.
And thanks to public education, of
yes.
which the Graduate Center at City University, I was then able, over the course of the next 6 years, to do my work for a PhD in art history.
You know, you were you mentioned those years in Paris, and it made me think. So, Giselle Freund had written one of the first histories of photography, and then Maria Morris Hamburg was at the curator at the Metropolitan Museum in photography, and with the field of photography, it seems like these. Women scholars and critics were really sort of pioneers in that field of this the way we understand it today.
Well,
were
you
in
to periodize it differently
yeah.
because Giselle Freund's Photography and Society,
right.
as it came out in English, published by Godin,
mm-hmm.
was a reworking of part of her 1936 dissertation
right.
that she did working at the Bibliothèque Nationale
right.
and in contact with Walter Benjamin.
Right.
And although Giselle Freund had published a number of books, also books with her own photographs, and then particularly
right.
portraits of people like James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, Walter Benjamin,
right.
it took a big lag of time before her Photography and Society
was translated,
and so on. Maria Morris came out of a completely different framework.
Ah.
Obviously, she was much, much younger
right.
than
right, right,
Freund,
right.
but she came out of the sort of art museum formation of
right.
photography as an art medium.
Right.
And she had worked at the Museum Truskowski,
yeah,
and was responsible for this very important series of books on Aceh.
Right.
That eventually went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I was always considered as a kind of, how shall I say, enemy of photography, because my work was, of course, deeply critical of,
yeah,
what I call the museumification,
yes, yes,
of,
yes,
photography. So Gisèle Freund comes out of one historical moment, which is the 30s, entre les guerres, between,
yeah,
the wars. Much later, Maria Morris comes out of the art, photography, museum,
yes, yes,
world. And I come out, you could say, ultimately from mass culture and,
right, right,
you know, photography in its social and ideological uses.
Yes. You know, I think in the introduction of your book, there's a reference to non-academic or non-art historians as critics of photography. For example, Susan Sontag, Rebecca Solnit, Jeff Dyer, Luke Sante. And in your work, you've always been concerned to address audiences outside academia as well as within academia. And I just wondered, from your perspective, the space for criticism and critical discourse today outside the academy, how would you say it's evolved in the time that you've been active as a critic?
Well, the Susan Sontag book was a work that kind of changed the discourse in,
yeah,
a way. Because she had already assimilated from her time in France the work of Barthes, different kinds of ideological critique. And the book, which came out of essays, review essays, that she had published in the New York Review of Book, really kind of changed the terms of how one might think,
right,
about photography.
Yeah.
But these other critics that you refer to, Jeff Dyer, Luke Song, they come along much later,
right,
I think.
Right.
Probably they're publishing in the 90s.
Right, right.
And
Rebecca
Solnit. Sontag book, yes,
yeah,
also in the 90s, whereas Sontag's two books, the On Photography, is 1977, and her last book, Regarding the Pain of Others,
right,
regarding the suffering of others, that's 2004,
right,
I,
right,
think.
I think,
yeah,
so, yeah.
So, again, Rebecca Solnit does not come out of photography.
Right, right.
From you.
Yeah.
You know, all the better.
Yeah.
Jeff Dyer is a kind of journalist who now does what I would call popular writing,
right,
about photography. I don't find it particularly critical.
Right, right.
So again, you know, one has to periodize when certain kinds of writing about photography appears, when it becomes part of academia. That's,
yeah,
also something that has to be mapped.
Yes, yes.
And finally, what happens when photographic practices become fully integrated into contemporary art, so that the boundary between a disciplinary entity called photography,
right,
and another entity called contemporary art have become totally porous.
Right, right.
Which puts in question all the institutions that were created from the 70s on that are specifically consecrated to photography as a medium specific,
yeah, yeah,
domain.
To just go back for a second to your path in academia, and it reminded me that Linda Nochlin and Rosalind Krauss, in their work, they've both addressed historical periods as well as been active as critics and writing about contemporary art, and as have you, of course. And I just wondered if your contact with them in that sort of competence in multiple fields and activity in multiple fields, was that significant for your decisions of what you were going to focus on and write about?
Well, intellectually, I think Linda Nochlin, who died last year, was, for me, of the most profound importance, because Linda Nochlin affected invented feminist art history.
Yeah.
Until she published her essay, Why Have There Been No Great Women Artists? There was no such thing as feminist art history.
Yeah.
And Linda's lifelong political allegiance was to feminism. And as it was for me, because I identified with feminism as soon as it was, how shall I say, as soon as it emerged,
yes,
in the late 60s and early 70s.
Yes.
Rosalind, of course, was a major intellectual influence,
right,
on my work. But the fact that both of them operated in the field of scholarship as well as the field of contemporary art was a good model for how to be a non-specialist.
Yes, yes.
And how to bring intellectual and political issues into both contemporary art and to one's quote-unquote historical scholarship.
Yes, fantastic. In your book, one of the things that struck me was the importance of language or text in complicating the reading of images, perhaps moving a viewer away from a naive reading. For example, the way the texts work with Susan Micellus's Carnival Strippers, or Glenn Ligon's Notes on the Margins of the Black Book, or for that matter, the work of Mary Kelly or Martha Rosler. Can you talk a little bit about how you think of texts functioning in relation to images?
Well, this was foundational work done by Victor Bergen, the British artist and theorist, who in a number of really brilliant essays talked about this fantasy of the purely visual, or the innocent eye, or that, you know, the photograph just transparently represents the world, and using semiotics, using deconstruction, using psychoanalysis, Bergen's essays were, I think, extremely important for thinking photography in a serious way, which is not to say that there weren't very serious works on photography. I can mention, for example, Pierre Bourdieu's An Art Moyen, a middling art, but that's the kind of sociological approach to the uses of,
right,
photography, particularly in vernacular forms.
Right.
Whereas the kind of work that Victor Bergen, Martha Rosler, Alan Sekulow were doing in the 70s and thereafter is a kind of ideology critique, as well as, what should I say, a kind of deconstruction of formalist notions of photographic meaning,
mm-hmm,
for which, of course, issues of text, textuality, intertextuality, and language are necessary elements of any serious approach, either to the medium or to a body of work.
Yeah. It's, it seems like the way that artists are trained might also have something to do with their conceptions of how they want to present image and text together.
But it's interesting that, particularly with Mary Kelly's monumental postpartum document, it's,
yeah,
about a refusal of the image.
Right.
And similarly, in Martha Rosler's brilliant Bowie and Two Inadequate
Descriptive
Systems,
yeah,
that's also an iconoclastic work, because although its nominal subject is the sort of documentary photography that would photograph homeless alcoholics in the Bowie,
yeah,
she refuses to do,
yes,
that and,
yes,
shows rather the language of drunkenness,
yeah,
and the photographs of the storefronts on the Bowery, but without any human subject.
Yeah.
So there's also a kind of iconoclastic impulse,
yeah,
that wants to refuse the imagined plenitude,
yeah,
of the photograph in order to get at discourses around maternity or discourses around alcoholism or what also called victim photography in,
yes,
general.
I think this connects with the general topic of course, power. In writing about the Abu Ghraib photographs in which U.S. troops sadistically tortured their prisoners in Iraq, that worked against the U.S. government line about the Iraq war. As I was reading that, I thought by contrast of the more recent images produced and distributed by ISIS, where their torture and execution videos are actually used by the militants as propaganda meant to encourage young recruits to join up and fight along with ISIS. Could you say something about how you think these propaganda images function for ISIS?
You know, I scrupulously avoided ever seeing them, looking at them.
Wow.
Because to me, to the extent that they're, and if you want to talk about pleasure,
yeah,
power,
yeah,
that's a literal incitement.
I mean,
literally to incite.
Yes.
To incite action, membership, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But as they get used, as they get disseminated on the web,
yeah,
they also have, they also incite forms of prurience, of sadism, because the encounter of any viewer with an image also involves very complex psychological mechanisms.
Yeah.
So to me, the whole thing is something to avoid rather than try to engage with, because what is really the point of denouncing decapitation?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, the more important issue is to say, what is it that provided circumstances and situations in which this would then become such a worldwide, I wouldn't call it movement, but and that's what, you know, tends always to be excerpted from the story. With the Abu Ghraib pictures, what was important were these were forms of self-representation. The, the guards, the soldiers were making these pictures for themselves, not exchanging them amongst themselves, but certainly not done as certainly not done in the service of, you know, getting people to support these, you know, horrible wars. So I think those are very, very different practices. And that I have a kind of, how shall I say, fastidious phobia about these kinds of photographs of torture, decapitation.
Absolutely.
I think it's healthy to avoid.
Yeah.
I mean, what would you learn from looking at it?
Yeah. It somehow maybe reminds me a little of, I think, Georges Didier Berman writing about Holocaust imagery and the kind of this scrupulous avoidance of that.
Well, that was a big debate, because when he and Clément Chéreau did an exhibition of photographs from the Holocaust, concentration camp images, a few, this famous four frames of women being herded into the gas chamber. This was enormously controversial, because should this be seen or should this not be seen? And the polemical text that Didier Oberman and Clément Chéreau wrote was to say, yes, these are images that, that must be seen, that should be seen. There is no point in repressing them. That operates on the side of repression. But it's a debate that, you know, that still has very complex ramifications, especially if we're talking about the kinds of photographs of, you know, torture and murder and so on and so forth. Even issues of rape, you know, there's a very strange argument made by Ariel Azoulay, who is an Israeli-born photography theorist, critic, about photographs of rape. Now, theoretically, you know, neither the rape victim nor the rapist should ever be represented.
Yeah.
And typically rapes don't take place in front of cameras, although as we know, part of the perversity of our age,
yeah, yeah,
you know, is everything can be photographed, should be photographed, etc. Her argument is somewhat similar to that of Didier Huberman and Clément Chéreau, that if the photographs are shown, these putative photographs that may or may not exist, it puts the debates around the act into the possibility of public discourse,
yeah,
and debate.
Yeah.
So that assumes that the exposure,
yeah,
of certain photographs somehow works against mystification, against fetishism.
Yeah.
I think we're going to equally make an argument that it does contrary work, or maybe,
yeah,
complication, it does both kinds of work.
Yeah, yeah. On a more sort of mundane level, I wanted to ask you also the question of power and self-representation. You wrote about street photography and Harry Callahan and discussed the question of consent, what it means to photograph someone without their permission, for example, by using a camera that appears to be facing one direction when you're actually shooting off to the side, and pointed out that Henri Cartier-Bresson actually used the terms of predator and prey to describe a photographer catching his prey, the subject, the idea that the street photographer is operating on his subject without their consent. And as a kind of counterpoint to that, I was thinking about this contemporary phenomenon of selfies everywhere, every city, every museum. I actually read a story, I think, from Paris about how fashion editors are very upset at fashion shows because outside the gates of the fashion show, there's a mob of street fashion people who are all dressed up and asking for their photograph to be taken, just waiting and hoping to be photographed and sort of causing chaos. And I wanted to ask you about maybe the contrast between these two cases. On the one hand, someone being photographed without their consent or not wishing to be photographed, and on the other hand, this desire to be represented, which is everywhere. And how do we make sense of these two kind of opposite perspectives, I guess?
Well, I think there are ethical issues that divide people who wish to represent themselves and post them and circulate them,
yeah,
and people who are photographed unwittingly,
yeah,
and without permission.
Yeah.
So these exist on completely opposite sides of the spectrum.
Yeah.
And this ersatz category of street photography,
yeah,
was one that always annoyed me. First,
yeah,
because it's ersatz.
Yeah.
Second, because it provides a kind of alibi for what I think is essentially an intrusive,
yeah,
practice that has, of course, a long pedigree. I mean, if you think of Walker Evans,
yeah,
photographing people on the subway who don't know that they're photographed, more recent practitioners like De Kircher and who's the other one? I find these are extremely problematic,
yeah,
insofar as they intentionally or unintentionally aggress the subject.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, I think, highly significant that this ersatz genre of street photography from Walker Evans, Gary Winogrand, etc., etc., of course, Harry Callahan, is basically an all-male preserve.
Yeah.
The only woman photographer I know of who, well, maybe two that might fall into this ersatz category is Helen Levitt, and,
yeah,
she photographed children in her neighborhood, and the fact that they were children already tells you something. And possibly Lisette Modell, who was the teacher of Diane Arbus, and we should here acknowledge that Diane Arbus's photographs were consensual.
Yeah,
that,
yeah,
that the subject is posing,
yeah,
for her. So I have a lot of problems with the notion that anybody in public space can be, in a sense, captured,
yeah,
caught,
yeah, yeah,
by, you know, the canny photographer with his quick reflexes,
yeah,
and then of course presented as an artwork.
Yeah, yeah. You observed that when Robert Mapplethorpe's work was shown at the Grand Palais in Paris, the critical reaction there tended not to address the question of race. Would you say that the question of race in art tends to be treated differently today in France versus in the United States?
Yes, I would. Yes, I would. I think that the occlusion of issues of race in the two Mapplethorpe exhibitions, there was one at the Musée Rodin and the other, you know, big one at, was it Grand Palais?
I think so.
Occluded, yeah, issues of race in a way that was almost funny.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, I don't think, would pass muster in the United States, because there is certainly a more heightened awareness of issues of race and representation,
yeah,
in the States than there is in France, for historical reasons and cultural reasons. So I was, you know, quite amazed at the absence of any acknowledgement of the politics of racial representation,
yeah,
in these two exhibitions. And even if you walked around it, of course, the spectators were all white, the,
yeah,
guards were black, and there were these photographs, the mostly the less, not all, but the less controversial ones, with everybody just saying what brilliant photography it was and how,
yeah,
outrageous. And but, you know, it was kind of general, in France, a kind of general occlusion of,
yeah,
of what seemed so so unmistakable,
yeah,
know, to American, to Americanize.
Yeah. We're talking with Abigail Solomon Godeau about her new book, Photography After Photography. Abigail Solomon Godeau's visit to UT Dallas was made possible by the Edith O'Donnell Institute of Art History. The Athenaeum Review is produced by Creative Disturbance and the UT Dallas School of Arts and Humanities. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.